jungle of death. Women, half beast, she demons.
Podcasting on all frequencies from the jungle of death, you're listening to Babes in the Woods.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Jungle of Death. This is Nyssa, and I'm here with Lindsay and Flumpy.
Hey!
Hello!
And today we are going to talk about one of our favorite authors, Neil Gaiman. Is that what he sounds like?
No, it's like Matt Damon in the South Park.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I feel like I've heard him speak, and I don't think that was my impression. He doesn't sound like him.
Well, especially the fact that he's British.
And gentle, and lives in Minnesota.
Lives in Minnesota!
Loves the Midwest.
Sorry, that was my, like, I love Neil Gaiman.
I love Neil
How
Gaiman.
He is.
Oh my goodness.
He is with his dogs.
Neil Gaiman would be willing to be sister wives to one Amanda Palmer, if you were willing to see this all.
Just to know, in case you're interested.
If you're listening, Neil Gaiman, all three of us are game.
Your wife's attractive and talented as well, and we share a passion for the ukulele, so.
That's fair. I share a passion for scarves.
I really can't think of anything that would make me a good match, except that I read Stardust 10 times in one day once.
Oh, Doctor Who. Does that count?
I feel a strange affinity for low-key Lysmith. I don't know, man. I don't know.
That's fair. That's fair. You would.
It's true.
So that's who we're talking about. Apparently, directly to, I apologize. It happens. Do we just want to start out with how we all came to discover this? You know,
how we met Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, more or less. Without ever doing it in person.
Theoretically.
Yeah, how do you describe that kind of a relationship?
It's a real relationship to me, I'll tell you that much.
It is.
I stumbled across Neil Gaiman, as I often come into these things. It was in the heady days of the early internet, so I didn't know when I found him in the Barnes & Noble that he was as important as he was.
In the Barnes & Noble.
I picked up the novelization of Neverwhere, and I read it in like two gulps. And I never looked back. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. It, you know, like, fed into my high school Anglophile, things. And, like, it made it London hip and edgy in ways I hadn't encountered it in other literature. You know, like, I think that there was too much the shade of the Dickensian in other books that I had read that featured the city so prominently. And he sort of became my gateway to other modern British fantasy writers, like China Miéville.
I
found him, you know, like, I read Neverwhere, and I freaked out. And then I went back to Barnes & Noble, and I bought American Gods, and I freaked out. And it was just a series of consecutive freakouts and readings. And then I eventually found his blog on the internet, and it just, you know, that was my experience. And I just can't thank Neil Gaiman enough for making such magical reading material.
I didn't realize until looking it up yesterday how early, comparatively for me anyway, I came to American Gods specifically, because it only came out in 2001.
Yeah.
I feel like I read it in like 2004.
Yeah.
And that's like super new for me. I never get to books before they're like 10 years old.
And I felt sad because he blogged American Gods. You know, I read, after I'd read American Gods, I read the blog entries he'd done on the subject, writing about it, occasionally giving excerpts, and it's, I know we're going to talk about it more later in our podcast, but the ways in which Neil Gaiman deals with fandom on the internet, I think he's sometimes much more graceful about it than some other authors, and he's very generous in his interactions.
I hilariously came through Neil Gaiman through you, Lindsay. I think you lent me Neverwhere. You were like, you have to read those. And I did, and then I loved it. I only recently realized that it was a novelization of the TV show or the radio show. I think it's TV
show. The BBC show, the production.
I think that the book
miniseries.
It's the most successful novelization I've ever read, in that I, too, was unaware that it was a novelization, even though I think it says so on the cover. And it's... I'm saying this with a lot of affection for that BBC TV series.
I was going to say, have you guys watched it?
It's not good. It's not good. It makes me upset. It has the worst soundtrack. Sorry. I know it's that guy. He's really famous. And I'll look up his name in a second or two. But
I'll look it up while you talk.
But please do. And so I watched the series. Like, I bought it on Amazon. It was kind of expensive for my budget tastes at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't
I remember
that? In your basement?
We watched it in your basement.
Yeah. Isn't it Eno Phillips? Are you looking
at it? Yeah, I think it is. I want to say that's what
it is. Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, so...
Oh, I was going to say that it's
Brian Eno.
Just really funny.
I always say Eno Phillips because of Emo Phillips.
Brian Eno.
Anyway, it made me want to pull my ears off, and it also featured prominently, what's his face? Michael from Lost as the...
Oh, Harold Perrineau. I love him.
As Carabas, or Barabas. I'm so sorry. Just weak on his name. Anyway, but the novelization succeeds in every way that the book, that the television version failed.
Yes.
But I haven't really listened to the recent radio production that much, and I'm really excited to.
It's really good. It's really good. They made it more difficult because initially they were going to have it up all year. At least that's what they advertised, and they would have it on the BBC website all year. Yeah. And now it's not up there, and they were releasing it through iTunes one week at a time. They release an episode, but they
are the ones still up.
I don't know. I don't know if they are. They might take them down.
I managed
now.
To get the first episode when it was Play of the Week, but I don't have any of the other ones.
You'll have to look again and see if it's up. I've heard excerpts from it, and just the excerpts. I ever listened to the first episode, and then I heard excerpts from a bunch of the other ones. And it's really good. It's really
well,
good.
It has to be with that cast.
But yeah, I mean, the cast is pretty amazing. I love Romola Gari. love her so much. And everybody knows about my Benedict Cumberbatch thing, and then it's Christopher Lee and James McAvoy.
I know, right?
I mean, you really can't go wrong with this cast. That's
not
the problem. And Tony Head. How much
Jeez!
Do I love
Shut up! Don't put Giles in there, too! My
I'm
vagina
sure
just...
Wait, hold on, let me verify that. I'm pretty sure he's in there.
Oh my god,
he's
oh my
so
god,
many
oh my
things
god.
Lately, like, he's just popping up in everything I'm reading.
I love
watching,
him.
I should say, randomly. I might have just made that up because I just really wanted to be in there. I feel
like you might have because I feel like you probably want him to be Angel Islington. But that's,
no, he's in it. No, Angel Islington is Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Stuart Head is, hold on, where is it? Hold up, where is it? So it's James McAvoy. Natalie Dormer is
she's Dor.
So Marjorie
right
Game of Thrones.
I love her. I've loved her since the Tudors. I love the way she looks. I described her once as a unicorn. Like she's beautiful to the point where she's almost not a sexual creature to me. But then she's so sexual. And it just destroys me every time. I just don't know what to do with Natalie Dormer.
Let me see. I want to see if I can find the total list of actors involved, because it looks like Anthony Stewart Head was involved. I just want to see who he's playing. I can't remember. I want to say I love him so much.
Side note about how much I love Anthony Stewart Head, I watched that terrible series Man-Child because I wanted to look at him.
Dedication.
I don't lack it, I'll tell you that much.
Here we go. UnleashTheFanboy.com seems to have a full list.
Of course.
Oh, he plays Croup. Anthony Stewart Head plays Croup. Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah. So that casting's pretty amazing. But I, kind of going back to discovering Neil Gaiman.
Through Neverwhere.
Through Neverwhere. It was usually, it's all through Neverwhere. But American Gods for me, I mean, I don't know if this was your experience, but growing up in the Midwest, I had that thing of, like, I'd lived elsewhere as well. And so, like, growing up in the Midwest felt very kind of, like, isolated and felt kind of like, oh, I don't like the Midwest, blah, 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 blah. I just want to get out. And then reading American Gods, which I think I read my senior year of high school, made me have this feeling of like owning something special.
Yes.
Like about the Midwest, which was really great. Like the fact that Neil Gaiman kind of like loves the quirkiness of the Midwestern naming system for towns.
Yeah.
And kind of this weird, strange mythology and having it set in places that normally, like, fantasy books are just not going to be set. It's the same thing that made me love Supernatural, the same thing that made me love, that gave me a great affection for Parks and Rec, probably more so than most people from the very get-go, was, like, this sense of it's both joking around about the tweeness and the ridiculousness of the Midwest while at the same time proclaiming its awesomeness.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a slightly different brand of the same place magic that, you know, Neverwhere represents. Like, it's just that London is so much of a bigger idea, you know, but, like, you know, the Midwest never had... I mean, we have an idea of it, but it's really sort of understated in its background because people who run the world aren't in the Midwest. They're not from it, so, like, they don't care or think about it, and so it's a very, you know, it's a backdrop, it's a painted backdrop from, like, a 50s musical, you know, you don't look at it, really, it's just kind of nice, because it's there, and things like American Gods, and by things like that, I feel like, was specifically, you know, it at least points out, like, yeah, there is a place magic here, like, we do have, you know, just as much to think about, it's just different.
And it also demonstrates Gaiman's range, like, he talks about London in very specific terms, and the Midwest with an equal expertise, and that's what I like about him so much, is that he transports you, and you feel all of his locations, like, all of his locations have these characters, and you're definitely in a
place, and you feel it, and I really like that. It's very atmospheric in the same way. I feel like it's the same level of atmosphere that I got from, you know, the Harry Potter books, because, like, that's just a universe you want to live in while you're reading it. But where I feel Gaiman succeeds, where Rowling failed, is that I actually care about the stories that he's telling also.
And then
stops being true with Harry Potter after all.
The other thing I loved about Gaiman from the first was that he writes such hapless heroes and such strong and in some cases literal bitch goddess female characters. It's his range in portraying scenes and then also portraying situations and portraying the characters that find themselves in those situations. And he's so adept at all of it. He's masterful. And that's, you know, that's what I sensed from the first in a novelization of a TV show that he had also written. You know, it's
crazy. I think an advantage that we have in reading the novels first, though, because I'm noticing with all three of us, and I didn't tell my story, but I also started with Neverwhere and moved on from there. Although I moved through everything out to the other novels through the first couple volumes of Sandman. I never finished it.
Oh my god.
Anyway.
We'll get to that later.
The advantage we have in that is that the novels start much later. They're all much farther along in his development as a writer. So we have the benefit of an already crystallized style and method, which I don't think we would have had we started out with earlier stuff. But that's okay, because I prefer novels, generally, to other forms.
I do, too. Generally, I tend to prefer... And I love his books probably more than anything else.
I agree.
But I love practically everything he's done. it's really hard, because I feel like you get this great relationship with an author, where you feel like, because you're reading their words, you feel like you really know them as a person. Because, I mean, writing is such a very personal activity. Like, you have to put something of yourself in there. Otherwise, you're a terrible writer. Yeah. Generally, the worst writers are the ones who refuse to put anything of themselves on the page.
Or the ones who do the whole merit suit.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Which is a different version of not really putting yourself in there.
Yes. Well, yes. I have the thing of the Mary Sue, which is that it bothers me, but I also admit in certain forms, I feel like, this is a side note, but I feel like you almost like, it's hard to look at it in the process because sometimes people are being
developed at the level. Author insert, like there's always a character that's meant to be you more than anybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not always the problem. Well, like, you know, we've got some combination of Sam Farley and Tyrion Lannister are basically George Martin.
Definitely George R. Martin.
You know, everybody does it. It's not always a bad thing. It's just when it turns into a Mary Sue instead of, like, an author insert character. Yeah.
Well, the nice thing about Gaiman is that when we talk about strong female characters, and I'm sure we'll go on off about this again later on, but it's that his characters, though, his female characters are selfish in the same way his male characters are selfish.
They're
my biggest
people.
Issue is, like, I hate watching people put forward these, like, perfect women, and like, perfect in every way. Perfect in their badassery, and perfect in their quips, and perfect in this, but they're always selfless. That's always something that happens.
Right. That's how girls are supposed to be.
But that's the thing is, like, I love that Neil Gaiman's characters feel so much like humans. Like, women can be...
Because they have actual desires. But, you know.
Yeah. It's just really great.
Not even evil, necessarily. It's just that they want things that make them seem evil, and they go after them anyway. You know, just like a guy would. Just like real people do. That's how you end up with bad people. They want something that somebody else doesn't want them to want, and they go for it.
It's kind of like villains in general. A lot of times the best villains are those that you like despite the fact that they are, you know, quote-unquote evil. And you typically, that type of villain falls to male characters. That's not really a female character type thing. The love to hate is very rarely female. It's typically male because they're roguish, they're kind of rakish, they have this sense of, like, attractiveness to them.
Yes.
And that's not something typically, like, evil women are portrayed as hags, they're portrayed as witches, they're older, they're striving
for
beauty.
Even if they're not, you know, then we have the whole, you know, they're horrible sluts or something. Like,
they're beautiful and sexual. Beautiful and deceitful as opposed to cute and comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's
and I love
my
that,
favorite.
I love that Dor is in Neverwhere. I really love how selfish Dor is and that there are definitely times when she's putting, oh
Richard.
My God, I just forgot his name. Richard, thank you.
No problem.
In Richard Mayhew. In terrible danger. It's mostly because she's like, fuck you, I want to go home. She's like, I totally just fucked over your life, and I kind of care because you seem like a nice guy.
We're like, I'm not really sorry,
but I wouldn't change anything.
Like, I'd do it again.
And I really like
really,
that about
it's
her.
Real life,
and you still like her, like, not that she's the villain of the piece, but you still like her. I love that, you know, you have the Angel Islington, which is, like, a very complicated and interesting character.
Yeah.
A terrifying character at moments.
Spooky as hell, dude.
Super upsetting in a lot of ways.
Super upsetting in a lot of ways. But I think it's a really, he's so good at creating villains. And creating, like, Croup and, is it Vandemore? Are so terrifying from the get-go, especially in the book. That was, like, the scariest passage I'd ever read at that point.
Yeah, well, and the idea that they're sort of eternal.
Yeah.
You know?
But, like, I love that they seem to be the main villain, and then Angel Islington becomes this
actually
other...
sort of super evil.
Yeah, and I love that there's just this, like, twist, and he really plays around with that, which I think
with
is great.
With expectations, generally, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say, Neverwhere has remained one of my very favorite. Like, everybody always loves American Gods the most. And I respect that. I do, but I don't love American Gods the most. I love Neverwhere and Stardust the most because I am a fairy tale person. And
I love American Gods, but I'm really excited about the HBO series that's eventually going to come out sometime at some point in time of American Gods. I know it's in development, and I'm really excited about it because if they can do it half as well as they've done Game of Thrones, it's going to be awesome.
It's going to rock everyone's socks off, and I love it. I love it because it's in a modern setting, too. I love, and we'll talk about this more later, but I love... the way Neil Gaiman will pepper the landscape with interesting characters, it's a feast.
Yeah.
It's a feast. You never, like, have a character that you're like, this is a throwaway character that I'm bored with. You know, like, his throwaway characters in American Gods are people like the Queen of Sheba.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, the Undertakers
so
in Memphis.
Super effective, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they all do things. He's got a sort of brilliant efficiency about him that you see in From Neverwhere, in our case, onwards.
It's true.
And, you know, even Sandman, which we'll talk about a little bit later, I hope, is the same way. Like, you fall in love with the peripheral characters in addition to the main.
Right, the idea that it's a complete universe, and, like, you only get to see part of it, but that doesn't diminish it. You know, like, everything feels solid and real.
Yeah.
We talked about, when we talked about Warm Bodies and how you kind of get dropped into a setting and you get dropped into a world, I think he does that so well, and he trusts the reader, which is always hard to do.
Oh my goodness, and I appreciate that so much. There are so many people who don't. No, I have to explain everything to you. Let me get it. I'll get there.
Neil Gaiman respects us.
It's true. Exactly. I think that's a good point to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the respect and the different ways that it is exercised. Welcome back. I think now we're going to talk about the various formats that Neil Gaiman has used to tell his stories and what we think about them. I think we're going to take an experts panel sort of form here. Expert being an extremely loose term.
Loose. The loosest.
Sure.
Neil Gaiman's comics are kind of the best. He sort of apprenticed under Alan Moore, who you may know from such, modern classics as The Watchmen. And he's crazy. He calls himself a modern shaman. And I think that worldview actually informs a lot of Gaiman's work in his oeuvre, The Sandman Saga. Sandman follows the Endless. They're the old gods, specifically Dream, who is the god of the Sleepland, as he reclaims his throne and his kingdom. And it's super cool. It's, like, the coolest thing ever. I'm not going to, like, outline the, like, plot too much for you guys, but basically the best parts about it have to do with superheroes interacting with gods, gods interacting with people, and the anecdotal storyline really lends itself. You also get the experience of seeing Gaiman find his voice. And one of the best female characters, in my opinion, of any Gaiman's works, in the form of Death, who is, again, one of the Endless, and Sandman's sister.
Favorite.
She's so great. I love her. Anyway, she's, and again, he's addressing our own fears of death by creating this character who's so awesome
and making her so approachable.
Yes.
Like. Absolutely.
Yes. So, I would say that to compare it to, other things that I've seen him do, it's, the format means that you're not getting as much writing from Gaiman, but he's really good at scene setting, like always. And the art is sort of the 80s, 90s comics art that you're accustomed to. So it doesn't have, like, it's visually different from some, like, superhero stuff just because it's more of a fantasy than what you see in, for instance, in X-Men. But it's still very much, like, a classic comics format, and that's part of why I love it so much. So if you're going to look into it, I'd suggest reading the first couple Sandman, but then also reading the offshoot single-volume Death, The Time of Your Life, which is just great, and it's just all from Death's standpoint.
That's cool. I only ever read the first few volumes of Sandman. I really enjoyed them, but it was really hard to get hold of them, so I didn't have them.
I have super expensive leather-bound editions that were given to me by my husband, who loves me, clearly. So, anyway, I recommend finding someone that's willing to buy them for you, and then present them to you, hopefully in wrapping paper that you get to tear apart. Like a Wolverine.
That does seem like the ideal way to encounter
a Wolverine or a honey badger ripping into amazing stuff. So
do I get to pick whether I'm a Wolverine or a honey badger?
I will let you choose. I will give you that freedom.
I like that idea.
I think that would depend on the day, though.
Right?
Sometimes I don't give a shit, but sometimes I wish I had adamantium.
Yes!
That's fair. It's always
exactly. Fair. It's always a Wolverine honey badger binary.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's difficult. I think, I don't know, or are we just going to go through and talk one at a time?
No, we can, like, interact with stuff about it, and it's just, like, I don't know. Do you get, like...
The first time we've done this format before.
It's true, we are not experts on very many
things. We are not experts on expert panels.
We can all talk about the novels a bunch, you guys, so...
That's true, we can all interact, which makes it easy on me, because otherwise I feel like it's an irrational responsibility for me to have to talk about the one thing that we all know the most about.
Nissa's all stressed out. This is basically this is stress breakdown.
I'm like T-Rex from Toy Story. I can't stand confrontation.
Mark your clocks, guys. 23 minutes and 53 seconds into the podcast is the moment where went off the rails.
We're a breakdown.
It's fine. It's okay.
There are a lot of breakdowns in Neil Gaiman's. It works. It's
true.
Coincidentally.
True. We're just being true to the format, really. Let's be honest.
That's what happens. But I think we discussed a little bit before that, like, the novel is, I mean, the advantage that Neil Gaiman's novels have is that they came much later in his career than a bunch of other stuff. So, like, he'd already figured out how to talk to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, sure, changing formats probably adjusts the way you have to approach that. But I think that once you've got a voice to use, it's much easier to figure out how to use it.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, we have that advantage. But I do think, as a person who generally prefers novels to shorter forms anyway, I think that, you know, they're all really successful at doing very different things. Like, I think all of Neil Gaiman's novels are fantasy, but sort of, certainly not high fantasy, but I don't want to say urban fantasy either, because, like, it's not like, you know, an incidental, like, Charles Lynn fairies are real sort of thing. But, and, you know, they're people and they have to have jobs and stuff like that. But, like, I don't know, there's just this more realistic sense to it. And, like, it's set in the real world generally, or
Absolutely.
A world that you feel like could be real. Like, in the case of Stardust, I mean, you want to go and find the Village of Wall and see, you know,
yes.
if there's a wall there. And, like, sure, maybe if you walk through the gap, nothing happens. But, like, maybe it's real. Like, you could find it. Or, you know, you want to go and see that real ridiculous carousel in Wisconsin or wherever it is.
And he blends his fantasy realm so well with what is real. And it's different from,
absolutely.
Like, you know, Tolkien's fantasy, which takes place in a different place. Or George R. R. Martin's. These are different continents, different planets, different people.
Right.
You can identify with them, but the unfamiliar landscape is sort of a part of a lot of high fantasy. And I'm happy that it's a part of high fantasy that Gaiman largely eschews. Actually, is it eschews or excuse? I never know.
I would say eschew
except in Sandman, where he uses it very successfully. But the realm of dreams, of course, is the unfamiliar.
It's supposed to be like that.
It's super cool.
It's supposed to be unfamiliar and magical and weird. And, like, you do get the realm of fairy in Stardust, for example, and it is different, and it doesn't make sense. But, again, it's a magic world, and it's attached to our world in a weird way. So, like, you can accept that it's different, and it doesn't work the same way, because you can always go back across the wall, and things will be, you know, English countryside in the, you know, early 19th century again.
Yes,
exactly. I think it's interesting that I was thinking about this while we were talking about American Gods a little bit. I think that it's interesting that it's the one that he's chosen to revisit. Like, the one, you know, like, obviously
going
all of these could be happening in the same world, but the timeline is the same. The, like, there are, like, familiar characters again. I find it interesting that Gaiman's so attached to it, and I think it has to do with his tenure in the Midwest, how long he's been there. And I know that he's, you know, I'm interested to see what The Ocean at the End of the Lane winds up being.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see that. Like, I'm excited about it because I haven't had a good novel to read. Well, that's not true, but like at all. But I'm excited because, I mean, I'm pretty sure the last Neil Gaiman book that I got excited about was the Graveyard book.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm excited.
That was a while ago now. What, 2008?
It's been a while. Like, he's been working on a bunch of other projects, which are great, and like different formats. But I would say that I loved the Graveyard book, and I loved Coraline, too. But one of the things I'm most excited about for Ocean at the End of the Lane is that it's a book that's written for me.
For adults.
As an adult.
Yeah.
And I love young adult stuff, so, and I'm not gonna, like, you know, bash it too much.
I do, too. I sometimes approach adult novels with hostility, because, like, it just happens that way sometimes. I think we should do a China Medieval episode sometime, so I can talk about my problem there. But
I think it's funny, though, because there is this weird kind of separation between adult and young adult. But what I like about Neil Gaiman is that frequently that separation doesn't really affect any aspect of his respect for the reader, which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
I think that's true. And I think that's an important part of anybody who's successful at, you know, young adult genre is, like, you can't talk down. Don't write like you're writing for children.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he has...
Well, and it's...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh,
he has
a weird...
I'm sorry, I'm just going to keep talking.
You go.
He has Roald Dahl's willingness to put children, child protagonists, into real danger that we feel as adults. You know, like, it's not like, I forget what I was reading the other day. There was a young adult book, and I was clearly, you know, like, this is kind of dangerous, but, like, these are not situations that I, as a fully grown human being with certain skills, not, like, Liam Neeson-level skills in Taken, but, like, skills would feel comfortable in. And I love Neil Gaiman's, like, just willingness to throw Coraline into this other world and be forced to save her parents.
It's terrifying.
It's really scary, but one of the things that I like about his writing is that not only is it a distinctive style, but it feels like such a fluid style that you can go from one book to a short story to a graphic novel. And there's a weird feeling that doesn't feel like there's a break in... I don't know, it sounds really weird, but I've gone on Neil Gaiman binges, and like it feels like you're reading all one big story, but it's all different genres and all different... ideas, and like there's always this underlying current of magical realism, which I really love, but he, you know, like reading his short stories, he's got Smoke and Mirrors, which is a great collection. I think it's called The Wedding Present. Yeah, The Wedding Present. I really love his Snow White, Snow Glass Apples story, which is really great, told from the point of view of the stepmother. A Study in Emerald, which of course is amazing, and has won a bajillion awards. He's got all of these different, I mean, you really look at them, and granted, you know, Sherlock Holmes, Cthulhu, H.P. Lovecraft being mixed in there is very different, but...
He's got three different authors all arguing with each other.
Yeah. But while you've got all of these, this undercurrent of, you know, science fiction or fantasy kind of slipping in there, it all feels very Neil Gaiman. It all feels like he's written this entire world that all of these other stories just sort of exist in different parts of this one world. Yeah. And it's really, it's a great feeling, like, to be able to get back into that world. So I'm really looking forward to Ocean at the End of the
Night. That's sort of true. That's like,
I can imagine, like, a dimension where these all exist.
Right, like, a shared universe sort of thing. Like, I feel like there's not that many people who do that.
There's a Neil Gaiman aesthetic, and it's
Neil
you
Gaiman
feel
is
it
like
when it's
an
there.
Entire comics house or something. Because like, you're supposed to believe that all of DC is one universe and all of Marvel is another one, and like all of Neil Gaiman is one universe.
I totally agree with that assessment. It's like when after Fantastic Mr. Fox, Wes Anderson took a break. You know, and like it was a long break, and I hadn't seen Wes Anderson work with actors in so long that when Moonrise Kingdom came out, my eyes like felt happy to be looking at his
yellow
stuff.
Things for a long time.
Yes. And I missed it. And that's why I'm so excited for Ocean at the End of the Lane. And it's not that Gaiman's
like,
been depriving us of other things, but a full-length Neil Gaiman book written for adults sounds like a vacation. It sounds like a big, good meal. It sounds like everything that is good. It sounds like a long bath. It sounds great.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like it's kind of, I'm really excited because I love Doctor Who. He has another Doctor Who episode coming, and his episode last season was probably my favorite episode of the season because I think the personification of the TARDIS is amazing.
She was so good.
That was so good. I loved it. It was so cute, and it also, for whatever reason, whether it's just really great casting or if it was really just the writing, but the chemistry between him and the TARDIS was so good that I was like, oh my god, screw every other love interest.
Like, no one needs a companion
ever. He can just walk around with, like, the personification.
Well, the companion thing's
TARDIS
gotten a little awkward of late, you guys. Like, it's gotten kind of awkward.
I don't like
what now? What has?
The companion thing. Like, visiting, them as young girls and, like, mysterious connections. And
that's not super creepy at all. Like, stalking Anya as a child.
Yeah, and, like...
Yeah, it's weird how it's very different, I think it just has to do with they're all coming to the end of their run, and it's kind of, like, their original ideas, I think, are so different from where they are now. And granted, I'm always willing to give them the benefit of the doubt because they do have like 16 episodes. We're two episodes in. So who knows? This could go.
Yeah, but I think we also need, and I complained about this some recently. I think someone needs to point out that it's possible for a woman to be a character.
yes.
without a plot device.
Yes.
No,
okay.
I agree.
And
I agree.
I recently read this really upsetting quote from Stephen Moffat that came out a few years ago where he said, we need to accept, like, something like the essential truth of the difference between men and women, that women need men more than men need women.
Oh, really?
Yes. And anytime I watch Doctor Who, I'm just filled with anger about his portrayals of needy women and, like, the aloofness
of
the Doctor.
That's super frustrating. I didn't know he'd said that. I mean, it's completely supported by all his work. Like,
well, here's the thing, though. I know. The reason why I liked Amy Pond, and I know I've talked about this in our Doctor Who episodes, I will do this only shortly, but the reason why I liked Amy Pond is because by the end, she really didn't need the Doctor. That's the point.
But she still had Rory.
Yeah, I get that, but it felt like Rory was a choice that she came to, kind of.
I mean, that's
like,
true, and I think that was a much stronger demonstration than we've had from any of the other companions. She's still my favorite companion, Amy Pond.
That's really frustrating.
That is really,
that's really upsetting.
Actually super angry, and I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Anyway, but Neil Gaiman.
Let's go back to Neil Gaiman because I love talking
Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman is never going to underestimate you or make you one-sided. I was going to say briefly that one of my favorite female characters in Gaiman is zombie wife Laura in American Gods, smoking cigarettes and just being an uber bitch and just like having to follow him around, and it's so beautiful. You can hear it in my voice, but like she's so atypical of any female characterization that I've ever read or seen in any media. And, you know, like, that's the thing with Gaiman is he'll come out with, or like Death making fun of Dream for being too somber, or Death making fun of people for being afraid of her. Like, he comes up with these full, she could have been a manic pixie dream girl, and she is to a certain degree, but he makes her enough of a developed character that you never feel that. And that's my thing with Gaiman, is that I feel like he loves his female audience, and he's very aware that, like, lots of women are reading his books, more so than men, I think.
Yeah,
I don't have any...
to have a basic understanding, at least, that, you know, women are people, and, like, mm-hmm. they get to be the same kinds of characters as men get to be, you know? It's just refreshing sometimes.
I agree.
It's amazing how difficult that seems to be for a lot of male writers. I was talking about, and again, this is kind of, like, a little off-topic, but... the movie Like Crazy.
Never
do that. Yeah, we never go off topic. the movie Like Crazy, which is not a genre film. But I had heard from so many men how much they loved it and how it reminded them of their first love and how it felt so innocent. And I watched that movie and all I could think about was how Anton Yelchin's character was such an asshole to her the whole time. There's this whole thing about him like going off on her for sleeping with somebody else when he's clearly done the same thing and doesn't tell her that he's done exactly the same thing. There's this whole thing about how he won't move to London because he has such a successful furniture business in Santa Monica, but her, which he could do anywhere, let's be honest.
Right.
And she has a very specific editor job that she gets at this really big magazine. She's worked her way up and he still insists that if they're going to be together, she has to move to Santa Monica and leave for that job. And she does.
No!
And was like, this is such a romantic movie. And I was like, this movie is terrible.
That's such bullshit.
And
oh my god.
And the reason that I realized it was when I went to look at the credits for it, it's written by men. It's written by like two guys. And
it's
I was like,
so
no
romantic
wonder this
when
movie.
Girls do what they're told.
But that was the thing, is like, they really felt like this was a really good representation. Like, most men I know who've seen this movie feel like it's a really good representation of young love. And I was like, it is, in terms of how stupid you are when you first fall in love for the first time and you don't realize that you have a say in what happens.
Right.
That was so angry.
If your lesson is roll over and take it because you're only a girl and can't make decisions, then yeah, it's a great
representation. Yeah, that's just how it felt. Like, you're just, like, watching it. It was, oh, so frustrating. It was... so incredibly frustrating.
That sounds
yeah, it's written by two guys. Oh, it drives me crazy.
I remember seeing previews for it and thinking it looked like it was going to make me furious.
Well, the
I
thing is, like,
I don't even remember hearing
it,
about it, and I'm not sorry.
I think it would be, like, a really, this is the last thing I'll say about it, but it, like, if I was going into it expecting it to be really heartbreaking and really sad, and I was like, okay, I was in the mood for that. I wasn't expecting to be so angry because I really thought it was going to be more like circumstances kept keeping them apart, and really it was that he was an asshole. that was why they kept being apart, and then he kept blaming her for it.
I remember reading I read a review an interview with the guy that wrote it, and he was like, this is based on a real relationship, like, she had visa problems, like, and I was like, this is a visa problem romantic comedy? Anyway.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, the premise of it is basically, like, they fall in love, she's in LA studying, and then doesn't want to go back to the States because she doesn't want to lose him. So she overstays her visa, but she has to go back for a wedding. Mm-hmm. And it's like, she, for some reason, they just portray her as being, and maybe people are actually genuinely like this, maybe I'm being condescending, but she doesn't seem to realize that by overstaying her visa, that they're going to know that she overstayed her visa by looking at her fucking passport.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're not going to let her in back into the country.
Yeah, no, like, and having overstayed, I think the rule is you're banned for 10 years.
Like, yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. Or you have to have, like, married, you have to go through the whole process.
That was why I moved home the day before my visa expired.
Wow, dude. No, I mean, I've had people, like, friends who I know have squatted in foreign countries, but it's definitely, like, been intentional, and they leave, and they know they're not going to be able to come back.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But, you know, you can hide out in a country for a long time. There's not enough resources to track people down.
You can't leave and come back. Like, that's not a thing that they let you do.
Yeah. Anyway, now that we've gone off topic, sorry.
So far off topic, but it's okay. But yeah, I agree that there's a game in voice, there's a game in aesthetic, there's a feeling that travels through that, in many cases, some of these characters would be friends or allies.
Yeah.
And it's just, it feels really awesome. There's something that comes from having a relationship with a writer like we all seem to have with Gaiman, which is that great comfort of familiarity, but, like, right. It's never not exciting. He's my book writer husband. That's what I would say.
I like that.
You know, I would commit to him forever. It's fine. George R. R. Martin I have more ambivalence towards and more anger about. So he's, like, my book ex-husband.
I feel like he's everyone's book ex-husband.
Right.
He really is. Because you're always so angry. He's also like that, I'm trying to think, you relapse into George R. R. Martin.
Yeah! Oh my god, yeah.
You never really, like, he's that person you really should be saying. He's the abusive, like, relationship that you have.
Because every time you go back, crap. You remember why you left.
You accidentally hate-fuck George R. R. Martin.
Yeah,
that's
kind of what it is.
A metaphorical term. I don't.
Ooh. I just
back with really, really, really warm, open arms with a scarf and a cup of tea by a fireplace with his dogs kind of playing with you.
Oh my god, his beautiful white dogs.
I know.
We're going to talk about his blog, but.
Yeah, we'll talk about his blog.
And I think that's a good spot to take another break. And so we're going to take a couple minutes and we'll be back and to talk more about a couple different things. And welcome back. We are ready to talk about a couple of children's books from Gaiman, and then we're going to talk about the blog, because we were talking about it a little bit already.
Can't stop.
So children's
won't
books.
Stop.
That was really...
Never again.
That really punctuated our point.
It did. It was a useful narrative.
I try. I strive for stuff. Striving.
Every day you're striving. It doesn't have enough syllables. It doesn't work.
I wish it did. That would be such a good song. But
struggling, on the other hand.
Yeah, every day I'm struggling.
No, stop it.
Doing it. Anyway, what I was going to say is I like Graveyard Book and Coraline as sort of counterpoints, where we have two really strong, in many ways, different protagonists. And he does...
It's true, yeah.
He does a young girl, and he does a young man. And it blows my mind how much I like Bod and Coraline in different ways.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that a lot of authors struggle with, I think. When you're writing a kid's book, you pick a gender and you go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes you pick a character and you go with them. But, and I think that a lot of people find it easier or more comfortable, I don't know, to make young adult books or kids' books about little girls, which is, you know, great. But I really appreciate that, you know, Graveyard Book has Bod instead, and it's not like he's a substitute for a girl character. He's just his own person.
And it feels like it doesn't feel like a book that only boys would enjoy, or
yeah.
a book that, you know, like, his Coraline is a book that actually I know a lot of men who really love that
yeah.
book. Which I think is really great, because you don't hear about a lot of guys reading young adult literature, let's be honest.
Well, and you always hear that crap about how, you know, boys won't read anything that's about a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that Coraline actually feels like the most traditionally masculine.
Yes.
Between the two characters.
Yeah.
I really love.
She's bold.
She's
bossy. Swashbuckling
she's
almost.
She's swashbuckling. She's so smart.
And
my one issue, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that her interactions with her parents, her defiance of them, and also her disappointment in them ring incredibly true, one.
Yeah.
And two, they're really unique, I think, in most literature, like, addressing, like especially her relationship with her mom. Like, you get a lot of defiant daughters, of course, in literature, as you do in life.
Of course.
But the ways in which Coraline is disappointed in her parents are really authentic, I think.
Well, and it feels so real. Like, you know, you remember, well, at least we remember being smart little girls, realizing that our parents are people and incomplete, you know, like, in the same way that all adults are incomplete. Like, no one is whole, and, like, having to figure that out when you're little feels really difficult, and it feels like a problem that only you have, because, like, everybody else's parents are perfect and wonderful.
But, Flumpy, you were making a point.
Oh, I was going to say, the only disappointment I've ever had, I feel like, in Neil Gaiman, was the Coraline film. And the reason why is because I felt like a lot of those attributes, and maybe this was studio interference, I have no idea, but I felt like a lot of those attributes were basically left out of the film version of Coraline. She becomes a much more traditionally female character. She's the only thing that's different is that she's mean. She's allowed to be mean, which is interesting, but I didn't like that, because in the book, one of the things that I love about her is that she's not mean. Like, she's not just, like, baselessly mean. She just feels like she's so frustrated because she's so much smarter than people give her credit for the entire
time. Right, nobody's taking her seriously, and she's tired of it, and she can't take it.
Even though as an adult, when you read that book, it is, you do recognize that all of her things, you totally understand what the parents are going through, and you totally get it from the parents'
perspective.
And
the exhaustion of dealing with a gifted child. Like, I'm sure all of our parents, like, you know, like, it's a total, like, I babysat a lot of kids, and I will tell you that the smart ones wear you out so much more than the dumb ones. Because, like, the dumb ones will just, like, they'll sit down and they'll watch a movie. They'll feel excited that you let them watch James Bond. It's the smart ones that are, like, picking your brain about stuff and expecting you to entertain them.
Yeah.
Exhausting.
It's hard because, you know, a kid who can handle it wants all the stimulation they can get.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, you know, realizing the parents aren't wrong. They're not bad parents. They're not doing anything they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no reason that their behavior should be modified, but you also feel her frustration.
Yeah. Well, and I love in the book, the thing I don't like about the movie is that it takes her a while to figure out that this world is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I love that in the book, it's an immediate instinct of, hell no.
Wrong.
Which, like, I think is a very natural thing for children, is that children in general do feel that. Children are not, like, we talk about how, like, children are naive. They are, but they also have an instinct of, this feels weird, this feels wrong, I need to get out of this situation.
Something is different here.
I would describe it actually as they lack the adult threshold for discomfort. Like, you know, as an adult, like, you're just like, well, sometimes things feel wrong.
Yeah.
Sometimes things are kind of shitty. But, like, when you're a kid, like, the expectation is there. Anyway, not to, like, shit on kids. But
it's why when you're a kid, I feel like you watch adult movies and you're like, why are they making these decisions? That's such a stupid move. Why did they go into that room? And then, like, when you...
don't go into the room.
I still do that. Sometimes
it's
people
so
are really bad at stuff.
Movies. I watch them now, and, like, there are moments where I'm like, yeah, I'd probably do that.
No.
And not because, like, I don't know any better, but because you just know that, like, well, you're, oh, no, there seems, like, you have a creepy feeling about your bedroom. It's so your bedroom, you have to go in there. Right?
Yes. But, like, it's things like in the Evil Dead movie where that guy's, like, he's transcribing the ancient dead dialect and stuff. And I'm like, what's your problem? Are you getting your PhD in this? Put that fucking down. You're supposed to be, like, entertaining your friend who's detoxing in the woods in the least fun cabin ever. I'm sorry. We can save this for my special Evil Dead tirade episode. But, anyway, people...
I have to say, if I found an ancient dialect that I felt like I could...
Nisa, you're going to get us all killed, dude. This is why I'm not going to go... to, like, any sort of rustic situation with you.
Well, that's okay, because I really don't appreciate rustic situations.
Yay! Friendship saved.
I'm really not a camping person.
Yeah, so anyway, this goes to everyone. All the precocious youth of America. You'd probably be transcribing Evil Dead text, and then everyone would die, hence the title Evil Dead.
If I felt like I could translate something like that on the fly and thus become, like, the darling of the anthropological...
Oh my god, Nissa, this is, like, the time you wanted to take the TARDIS to go to the plague times. This is exactly the same thing. This is the same impulse that I have a problem. I have a problem with it.
So I would avoid the 14th century. Like, it'd be fine.
That's such a claim.
That's really funny.
That's, like, the claimiest claim of all time. But, back to Neil Gaiman's children, I would say that my thing about Bod that I like, because we talked about Coraline a bunch, excuse me, is that Bod is this, like, introvert, this hesitant introvert. He feels like a younger version of a shadow, for instance.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, like, I like that, you know, child characters can be one-sided. At times. Yeah. Neil Gaiman doesn't write children like they're one-sided.
You know, personality traits to deal with.
Yeah.
Some kids are two-dimensional.
Yeah. Especially those kids on television programs, cartoons.
Those kids especially.
Are two-dimensional.
Possessing only two dimensions does make it difficult to be well-rounded.
Yeah. Sorry, dudes. Case of the Sillies here at minute 51:39.
That's the moment we went off the rails.
That other one was just a fake out.
It was to keep you on your toes.
We got to throw you some red herrings in this.
I do want to mention Graveyard Book being the book. It's one of my favorite Neil Gaiman tropes, which is that he takes a story that we know so well, like Neverwhere is very clearly Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
Yes.
Greater Book is very clearly Jungle Book. And it does such a wonderful job of making that a story that I actually care about, first of all. And second of all, I love how it's
nobody got time for talking animals.
Whatever, well, Shere Khan's totally really scary, funny. Dude.
Mowgli just always seems so dumb to me. I can't even
Mowgli write. Does seem dumb. I agree.
He's so not dumb.
Hard. When I turned like 12, I was afraid that made me racist. Like, really afraid.
No, it makes Rudyard Kipling racist.
Yes.
Also, how did he learn how to speak English? In the Disney version, obviously, that was for sure.
Because Baloo spoke English.
I was going to say, because all of the animals around him were, because Bagheera was a dignified English gentleman and taught him
to speak. I love Bagheera, I will say that.
Bagheera was my favorite because he's a stick in the mud, and those characters are always my favorite.
Yeah, I know. Someone likes the Archimedes of the world.
We all know you love Archimedes. We all know you love Archimedes.
Nissa is Archimedes.
It's true. I have that problem.
My big thing with Graveyard Book, though, too, is that I love how subtle some of the supernatural elements are, which, granted, is, again, another Neil Gaiman thing, but I love that, despite the fact that it's set in a graveyard with ghosts, it just feels so natural.
Right. And it feels like this is actually a thing that might be true.
I love that, like, the whole idea of a vampire and a mummy and a werewolf are hinted at. They're not something that's stated outright.
Yeah.
And you have to really infer it. And that's what I mean when he says he trusts his young adult readers the same way he trusts his adult ones.
Right.
He really...
The kid's going to see that and recognize it, whereas another author would be like, I have to tell you, this means there's mummies somewhere.
I think... I think that, like, you're
and then you get a huge mythology of the history and origin of the mummies. The mummies came to be when something something.
I would read that.
Gore Verbinski.
I was mad when I found out Princess Bride wasn't actually an abridged book.
Oh, I love that book, though.
It's so good.
I think
I would have read all of that dry crap, because I love it.
Yeah, I know you would.
I like the,
all other authors are bros, because that's the same as my bro.
I would say about the Graveyard Book that I love, to the sadness of it, in his relationship, that friendship with the girl, and then she asked that her memory be erased because it was just too traumatic.
Oh, you know? God, that part's so terrible.
This is
so
a book for children, or, like, this is a book for young adults, and he's not afraid of saying to them, like, I know that you feel the whole range of human emotions. Just because you're a younger person doesn't mean that you don't feel sad.
Things are hard and sad for you, too.
And I really love that about him. And you see that in Coraline as well, as she struggles with the challenge that's been put in front of her that's a challenge, again, for, like, any person.
Right, it would be hard for any of us, and she's only little, and she has to deal with it anyway. Like,
yeah, well, and I think that there's so much
Bob grows up with people who are already dead. Like, what's not sad about that?
There's a delicacy to the way he handles that, and, like, the relationship of Bod and his, like, adopted ghost parents, like, in the way she longs to, like, be able to give him physical comfort and can't. Like, there's such a... Neil Gaiman is great at writing things that are beautiful and sad, and he doesn't skimp on that. In any of his formats, so.
There's a really great sense of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, like, what the word is that I'm searching for, but I just love how, maybe it's melancholy his characters are. I tend to love, I love Alfonso Cuarón, I love a lot of auteurs, whether it's authors or directors, who tend to, they lean more towards sadder stories that have flashes of hope, which is generally what Neil Gaiman does, is a lot of times his characters are in incredibly desperate situations, even in American Gods and Neverwhere, and there seems like there's no hope of getting out of it. This is an eternal struggle. Yeah. And then there's, like, those little flashes of hope. And in the Graveyard Book, what I love is that so much of it is about life itself, and he tells it through a story about death, which I think is beautiful.
Right.
That could be a whole episode in itself, actually, is Neil Gaiman's treatment of death.
That's very true, yeah.
I would love to do that at some point.
Also, that'd be a great excuse for all of us to read Sandman.
Dude.
That's very true as well.
Beach a boat.
Get on trying to track that.
Somebody's got to be first, right?
It's me. Victorious laugh.
Episode on Medieval Lit, I'll be first.
Uh-huh. All right, time machine.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not wrong.
Anyway, so we're coming to the end of this episode. You guys want to talk a little bit about Neil Gaiman's blog, or just our feelings?
The blog.
I would say,
and the whole concept of author blogs.
He wasn't the first, I don't think, but he seems to have been the one that has.
I think he was the first one I followed, at least. You know?
Yeah, I'd say he's the first one I followed. George R. R. Martin was second, and that was a mistake.
Don't ever read.
But I think it's very interesting the way Neil Gaiman interacts with his fandom in terms of, he puts a lot of personal things on there.
It's sometimes true, and you get the sense that he actually cares about people, like, not necessarily individually, but, like, each individual gets the same,
well,
you know, level of interest, I guess.
There's that danger of knowing too much about an author's life, but there's also that, you know, like, Orson Scott Card, to give an example.
Dead to me!
The happier you are.
Dead to me.
Yeah. But, that sense of, like, when his dog died and reading that
book. That was the saddest thing. Oh, my God.
It was so hard to read because it was just, he was so open about his grief.
Yeah.
And it was a really beautifully written,
we've all been following the blog since before he even found that dog, right?
Yeah.
Like, we have known through the blog that dog as long as he has. I mean, not the same way. Obviously, it's not the same for any of us, but, like, it really lent, for me at least, to the difficulty of reading about that. Like, I was way sadder about this person I've never met's dog I've never met than I've been about a lot of things, you know? Not least because dogs dying is always, like, sad.
It's the saddest thing. There was some terrible Lena Dunham tweet recently where she was like, I get tired of people talking about their dogs. And I was like, bitch, shut up.
Yeah.
You know, like, I love people talking about their dogs. I love dog characters in any form of media. And I love that Neil Gaiman loves dogs, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
and his dogs are so pretty and so
beautiful.
Great.
beautiful in the snow, in the snowy pictures of Minnesota that he posts. I think that he's really gracious to his fans on the blog. I think that the blog feels natural with him in a way that it doesn't maybe with some other authors where I've tried reading their blogs. And coming back to it, I come back to his and I come back to Joss Whedon's. Because it's fun to read what they're just doing. Like, and and they never make it feel like, you know, Neil Gaiman famously wrote the blog post, George R. R. Martin is Not Your Bitch, which was about fan expectations. But it's interesting coming from a man who is so willing to interact with his fans, even when they're demanding.
At the same time, he's, you know, not willing to sell out his professional activities to fan demand, which is great, and I think that's what he was making.
I think that's the thing that's interesting to me is that I actually feel like George R. R. Martin's work is shaped more by his fans than Neil Gaiman's is, in terms of their demands and their wants.
Yeah.
And I feel like, to a certain extent, George R. R. Martin does engage in a lot of wish fulfillment in a way that Gaiman does not.
Right.
And that's not to say there is no wish fulfillment in Gaiman, because I feel like that entire universe that he's created is a certain amount of wish fulfillment for a certain type of kid. Like, who really craves that sense of escape.
What was that thing he said about winning the Carnegie Medal? Like, if you make your 7-year-old self happy, you're doing all right. And it's like sending a letter to your 7-year-old self or something like that.
Well, he's also talked about creativity, and his views on art, I think, are really interesting. His views on the importance of art with kids, and I've engaged sometimes because I have a lot of teachers around me, and I have some teachers whose opinions are essentially like, even English teachers who are like, kids just need to go into math and science, and that's just it, because otherwise they're not going to have any chance of future, which I get, and then that's
but the
sense of it is.
What's the world going to do when everybody goes into math and science?
That's the problem.
And it's
that's
just
the issue.
The thing is, too, like, the ways in which we were talking a little bit earlier, offline. About discovery and the culture of discovery and, like, you know, the fact that Red Bull sponsored the space jump and things like that. Every human innovation has been sponsored. You know, Columbus wouldn't have found America if Ferdinand and Isabella hadn't felt like sponsoring his voyage. Like, we all need to make an investment in all kinds of knowledge. You know, like, it's just, I find it really upsetting the way in which, certain kinds of knowledge are being devalued, and especially with literature and with writing.
Well, the idea that education is being monetized.
Yes, but like, with writing and with English specifically, I'm seeing a decline in the general editing of mainstream news sources. Like, I'm seeing evidence
that...
Well,
you can't read an article on, you know, CNN or anywhere else that doesn't have a major typo in it.
Yes.
Like, major, not just, like... tech instead of the, like, you get major ones that are, you know, semantically significant, but nobody caught it, you know.
There's
part of that is because they basically have gotten to, this is a whole other thing going into blog systems, but a lot of times you might have an editor, but that editor, you have one editor for, you know, like 20 writers who are all churning out several pieces a day.
Yeah.
So that editor can't keep up, and it has to do with demands of, really what we need is more people who are involved in this industry to take up more positions, to be able to...
But there's no money in it, so they can't, you know, suggest to children that they go out
and it's
and
just such a fake
job.
Idea.
And
it's such a fake idea that the free market should be given rein in a classroom. Like, let's talk about how that's really fucked up. I mean, it's just dumb.
There's also this sense, too, I feel like, of standards being lowered in terms of math, or not in terms of math, in terms of writing, and the idea, I got really annoyed when handwriting suddenly became... Even the sense of cursive not being taught and, like, the sense of real handwriting not being taught anymore because, well, typing is all they're going to see. Like, it's all they're going to deal with because of computers. And what's frustrating about that for me is, like, you're telling me essentially that it's hard, so let's not teach it.
Right.
Like, not that it's hard to teach, but that it's hard for children to get and that they're not going to have a direct need for it.
Right, that they
so
might not need
it
every minute. Every day, except you will, like, if you choose to go into anything that isn't math or science, even math and science, like, shit gets written down by hand.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind is,
use cursive.
The other thing to keep in mind, and maybe this is my obsession, not obsession, but preoccupation, perhaps, with apocalyptic ideas, but eventually, I'm sorry, but this whole thing is just not going to be sustainable at some point in time, and there are going to be times when, I mean, even if it's 200 years from now, 500 years from now, 50 years from now, but essentially what's going to happen is this whole thing is going to implode on itself at some point in some part of the world. If you don't teach children how to survive without computers, they have absolutely no idea what to do when this happens. And we're going to be doing a disservice to the future generations by not, this is me being like these young kids today, but really it's this sense of, I know people who have no idea how to write a check because they've never had to write a check before.
Yeah.
And so when I hire people at my job and we do direct deposit, they're like, oh, I don't have checks. Like I don't have any. And it becomes an issue now because there are actually still areas of the world, but there are still areas of the world, like even in LA, where you can't do it electronically. You have to write a check. Therefore, they suddenly get into this position where they can't pay rent because they didn't realize they couldn't do it electronically.
Yeah.
And they get into trouble and it causes issues. And it's just stuff that, like, eventually everything's going to move onto one system and that's fine. But what happens if that one system fails?
I would say, too, my problem with it is that when we pass value judgments on kinds of knowledge and the practitioners of those, we're devaluing them as human beings.
Well,
that's what you feel, and that's actually, to bring it back around to Gaiman a little bit, one of the things I love most about him, in addition to everything else, and it's most prevalent in American Gods, though it's there in his other works as well, Shadow is an ex-con. Shadow is in prison when we meet him. Shadow is a person that would be devalued in our society at every turn.
Right, he's not a protagonist by anybody else's measure.
Absolutely.
And Neil Gaiman shows us that people are valuable regardless of what they're doing, what they're, you know, where they've been. Like, and that, you know, the fact that, like, this man has gone to prison in, like, modern American society probably, like, eliminates him from most of the workforce, you know? It's just,
he gets to be a god. Okay.
There's a hopefulness to Gaiman's writing that I feel like is an anecdote for some of the darkness of our times.
Absolutely. I also think one of the things that I love about, and this is just to go off on Shadow, and one of the reasons why I really like American Gods, but the thing that I really like is, again, going back to his realism and his sense of what the real world is like, is that he doesn't romanticize the idea of being an ex-con. He doesn't, like, turn it into,
ex-cons are like this. Like,
well, also, like, he's not like, oh, so he's street smart. Like, it's not like, I love, like, movies like The Sting, but he really treats it like this is something that now is more of a depressing state for him to be in as an ex-con. It's a really difficult thing. He doesn't have that, which a lot of people who come out of prison have that sense of loss of, like, having too much freedom.
Yeah.
And so Shadow gravitates towards kind of being told what to do and kind of being part of this bigger story, and he gets wrapped up in it. And it's only through that he gets this sense of, like, oh, I have this freedom to make my own choices.
Right. He gets to develop, you know, his own comfort with being able to make choices.
And I think that it's kind of an interesting aspect.
A lot of lockup, so I feel like I've seen this a lot in people who go back to prison on purpose.
Yeah.
Well, I think it goes back to Gaiman, though, being, talking about his blog and talking about who he is and the speeches he's given, there is that idea of who he is kind of bleeding through, but also that idea of him well researching things. And I think there's an empathy. This kind of ties into his fans and what he, his graciousness with his fans, I think, also ties into he really tries to see everything from everyone's point of view and really see it. He seems to really try to empathize with people in general.
I agree.
And that's the last thing I'll say, sorry. So should we wrap it up here?
I think it's as good a point as any.
All right, let's do that.
So now that we've decided to wrap up, I guess we're going to say we're all done with, well, not all done, but for now, we're going to stop talking about Neil Gaiman and let you all make your way out of the Jungle of Death.
Bye.
Bye.
We'll see you next time.
Safe travels.